Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCaine. We continue our treasure hunt for solutions, talking with people who create solutions to seemingly impossible problems. Today, we'll be talking about solutions to the global energy crisis, which actually has three major facets: the climate crisis, the security of oil supplies, and nuclear proliferation. All of these facets are related, and let me just take a minute to say how. We know that our climate is changing from warming temperatures to more frequent and fierce storms like Hurricane Sandy. Evidence continues to grow that these climate changes are due in large measure to carbon being released in the atmosphere, primarily from the burning of fossil fuels like oil and coal. What are the solutions to the climate crisis? We know that using more renewable energy sources like solar and water power can help, but the use of renewables is still relatively small. Some say we should turn to nuclear energy as an energy source to replace coal, but nuclear plants are very expensive and can be very dangerous, as we saw in Japan with the Fukushima disaster. Moreover, use of nuclear energy generates materials that can be used for nuclear weapons, making us vulnerable to greater nuclear proliferation. So, what can we do? Fortunately, there is a brilliant scientist who is focused on creating a path forward that solves the global energy crisis and its related problems. Dr. Arjun Makajani asked the question, is it possible to meet our energy needs without emitting carbon or relying on nuclear power? His research led him to say yes with confidence. Dr. Makajani lays out the path forward in his book called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. It is the first analysis of a transition to a U.S. economy based completely on renewable energy without any use of fossil fuels or nuclear power. Dr. Makajani is here with us today to talk about his exciting work. Dr. Makajani, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks so much, Eleanor. I'm really glad to be with you on your show.
Thank you. Now, tell us a little bit about your background, because this is amazing work you're doing. So I just want people to know a little bit about you and your story. You're an American electrical and nuclear engineer who earned your Ph.D., I think, in nuclear physics from the University of California at Berkeley.
Slightly yes? Inaccurate.
I got my doctorate,
yeah, actually originally from India, but I got my doctorate in nuclear fusion from the electrical engineering department there. So the physics discipline is plasma physics, not nuclear physics.
Okay.
But it's a minor detail. I have studied nuclear energy quite a bit, nuclear fission and fusion. And while I was doing my doctorate, I was the principal author of the first efficiency study that was ever done, exploring could we do the same things we do with less energy to create less pollution and use less uranium and so on. And I was surprised to conclude that we could. That was in 71. And then 6-7 years ago, my friend and mentor Dave Freeman made a speech, and he ran the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, so he's run electric utilities. And he said we should get rid of coal and oil and nuclear and go to solar, and I thought it would be very expensive. And he pointed out that I hadn't done the research recently, so why didn't I take a look instead of just offering opinions? And so that's how carbon free and nuclear free came about. And I was a little bit surprised to conclude that we are in the midst of a technological revolution that, with a modest amount of determination, we can make it happen. We can go to completely renewable and economical. See, we've always been able to do it, but it's been a question of, is it affordable? And I believe it is.
Fantastic. And along with Mr. Freeman there, wasn't also Dr. Helen Caldicott was at that same meeting and asked you to write this book, did she not?
Yes, actually, Helen, who is a good friend, sponsored that conference. And so all of us spoke there, and she was very excited after Dave's speech. And we were chatting, and when I kind of gave a kind of negative assessment of Dave's speech, and he challenged me to actually take a look, she said that Dave had made the most important. Now, she's made a few important speeches herself, as you know.
Yes,
she
many.
She said Dave had made the most important and hopeful speech that she'd ever heard, and that if I did this study, she would raise the funds to do it. Now, that's an offer that no one who runs a nonprofit can ever refuse, especially for a really interesting study. So Dave and Helen and several others were on an advisory board kind of overseeing the study and commenting on it and helping keep it on an even keel. And carbon-free, nuclear-free was the result. So, yeah, very much. Dave Freeman and Helen Caldicott inspired that book.
Good. And just for our listeners, this is Dr. Helen Caldicott, who was who's a medical doctor and a professor at Harvard Medical School, who went on to work exposing the dangers of nuclear energy and weapons, and actually won the Nobel Prize for her work. So that's a major powerhouse you got in your corner there.
She's very amazing and inspiring, and I think she must have inspired more women to do work on getting rid of nuclear weapons and worrying about nuclear power than any other person I know of.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm one of them. I heard Dr. Caldicott speak at the University of California, and she talked about the dangers of nuclear weapons, and it's what inspired me to get involved in the peace movement. So I am one of her proteges here, and I ended up working with her on her organization for a while.
No, I see. Okay.
So now you examine the technical and economic feasibility of having no carbon dioxide emission and no nuclear energy. So you
right.
say initially you were skeptical it could be done. Why? Because you thought it would be too expensive?
Yeah, well, that was one of the reasons, yes, because, you know, as you know, solar and wind are both variable, and, you know, you don't always have wind, you don't always have solar. So that was one issue. Wind power was already pretty economical in terms of you put up the set of turbines, can they generate economical electricity? The question was, you can't do just that. You know, you have to have other sources, or you have to have some way to store it. And so you're adding another level of cost. And in 2006, solar electricity was probably about five times more expensive than it needed to be if you put it on your rooftop to compete. Or at that time, probably six times, because power is a little bit cheaper then. And I thought, you know, it didn't look plausible to do it at reasonable cost. But the thing that changed my mind when I did the study was not that my assessment of cost at that time was wrong, but I could see that unlike the previous enthusiasms, and I always try to be a cautious person when I make my estimations about what's possible, although it might not seem so from the result. I felt that the pace of technological change in solar and to some extent in wind energy and in energy storage was accelerating, and that the conditions that in 10 or 15 years, you know, well, storage would be economical, say by 2020, that we could have electric cars and that we would have economical solar energy and that wind would become more economical. Those were, if married to more efficient use, which is always the cheapest thing to do, could result in our not only not burning a hole in a pocketbook, but we could do things at about the same level of cost in relation to our income as before the first energy crisis. So that's a pretty amazing conclusion, you know, to have arrived at. And I'm very comfortable 7 years on, or 6 years after I finished my book, that actually I was a little bit cautious. I think things have developed faster. Today, solar photovoltaics in Germany, if we could get the costs, labor costs, the way they are in Germany, here in the United States, and people are working on it, we would have solar energy that's completely competitive without subsidies with commercial energy in many parts of the country, including Maryland, where I live, California, New York State, and many other places. Not all places, but many places. Wind energy already cheaper, and much cheaper than nuclear, not only according to my assessment, but today according to the assessment of the Energy Information Administration, which is part of the Department of Energy, which is not known as an anti-nuclear organization. In fact, it spends a lot of money promoting nuclear energy.
So the big breakthrough for you, the big aha when you were doing the research, was that the technology was rapidly changing, and in the time since you put the book out, you're seeing that not only is that true, but it's actually accelerating with the technological advances for the renewable energies, which makes them cost competitive.
Yeah, so to give you an idea of the change in my own thinking, is when I finished my book 6 years ago, I thought that it would necessarily take very major legislation, a price on carbon in some way, you know, emissions or like a tax or a trading system that was significant to make things, you know, and federal regulations and so on. Today, I think, because states are more in the leadership, as you know, historically that is the case. States have been in the leadership of good and bad things in the United States.
Yes.
And fortunately, in this case, they are like the state we live in, or I live in, Maryland or California, Minnesota. Many states are in the leadership of this energy revolution. And because we are moving so fast, things are also becoming... One of the key things, just to give you an example of what it means to say this word technological revolution, the price of silicon, which is used to make solar cells, was very high at the time, but it was clear that the amount of silicon that would be needed to make a solar cell was going down rapidly because of technological change. New companies, new research was making it possible to economize on it, and it was also clear that the high prices were due to bottlenecks in production and not some inherent thing in the cost of the product. That was one thing. The other thing I realized is the cost of solar cells doesn't depend so much on how many solar cells you're producing in a factory. And this was an insight that was new to me, but familiar to people in the industry, that it depends when the machines that make the solar cells become industrial commodities themselves, when they're not all custom made, that's the point at which solar cells have become very economical. And that is what has happened in the last few years, because production has increased, there's been a shakeout with the producers, many small producers have fallen away. That's happening, you know, of course, it's not always happy news for all the companies involved, but for the overall market, it's been very healthy. And solar panel prices 5 years ago, 6 years ago, were $4 a watt. Today, they're 70 cents a watt.
Wait a minute, you're saying solar was $4 a watt and now it's 70 cents a watt?
No, that's just for the panel.
The panel
cost $4 a watt.
Okay, for the panel.
A few years ago. Oh. Today you can buy one for 70, 80 cents a watt. When I installed solar on my house just 3 years ago, it cost me $5.75 a watt completed to do the job before subsidies. Today in Maryland, you could probably get the same job done for $4. And I think in 4 or 5 years, you could get the same job done for $2.
Fantastic. So part of the good news here, since you know, you and I both live in the Washington, D.C. area, and we're acutely aware of the profound dysfunction in Congress, including the incredible influence of the big corporations. So we know how tough it is to get legislation through Congress, but from what you're saying, it sounds like this is a technological revolution that's happening anyway, and we don't really need, obviously it would be nice to have Congress being proactive, but that actually this revolution is going to happen whether Congress passes any legislation or not. Is that right?
Well, you know, I think it is feeding back to the federal level. So, for example, the Pentagon is a leader in renewable energy and efficiency in microgrids. You know, we had Hurricane Sandy last year, and people realized that when the grid goes down, people get stuck in elevators. You have lots, you know, you have lots and lots of, you lose electricity for a week in Manhattan, in lower Manhattan, and it causes personal health and economic havoc. And the Pentagon has realized the same thing. They've actually become a leader in microgrids. They are among the largest procurers of solar electricity in the United States, and also procure efficiency for their bases. And they're also leading in alternative energy because, you know, in Afghanistan, it was realized it was costing $400 a gallon to transport fuel. A lot of people were dying in the transportation. So, of course, if you have solar energy right there, then you don't have to transport all that fuel to the field, and people don't have to die transporting it. So there are a lot of angles from which this revolution is being pushed. Of course, there's the Germans who decided not to have nuclear. The Chinese are choking themselves to death with pollution from coal and oil, and so they are the largest installers. And you mentioned Fukushima. You know, after Fukushima, Japan was not doing much on renewable energy. Now they are the second largest market, bigger than the United States, even though they have far fewer people, for solar energy.
Amazing. You know, let's talk about this Pentagon for a minute, because clearly you're talking about an institution that no one would accuse of being kind of a very lefty group that's just pushing some kind of fringe technology.
Yeah, right.
But the Pentagon, it's interesting. I talked to a fellow who very high up in the Pentagon who was talking about national security, and he was speaking about these renewable energy from a security point of view. I mean, it was totally about security from
exactly
their point of view, because the Pentagon is the people responsible for keeping us all safe, and they are acutely aware of the vulnerability of the oil supplies, which, you know, many of which come still from the Mideast, and they are asking themselves the question, what if that oil supply gets disrupted? What happens in the United States? Now, we're fortunate to have had oil discoveries in North Dakota and, you know, high amounts of oil production in the United States itself right now, which has relieved some of the pressure for imports. But still, you know, we import a bunch of oil in this country to keep our whole economy going, our homes, our businesses, our vehicles, our military itself. So it is really clear that if you've got the Pentagon saying, you know, we want to have solar electricity, they know if they want to keep going to provide our defense, they know they can't rely just on oil for their energy. So I think it's an amazing demonstration of how critical it is to be going to renewables when even the Pentagon is moving that way.
Well, also, climate is not just an environmental issue. It's an economic and security issue. And I think the Pentagon's done some work on how big a security issue it could be. And then, of course, the frequency of extreme events creates the need for more secure energy supply. So one example actually also comes from the tsunami and earthquake in 2011 in Japan. So there was not just a nuclear accident, of course, but the tsunami destroyed a lot of towns and villages, or coastal parts of towns and villages in that area, including much of the port of Sendai. And the port of Sendai got blacked out because even the houses that were standing didn't have electricity because their transmission and distribution infrastructure got knocked out. But there was one point of light. There was the Tohoku Fukushi University in that area that continued functioning without a break because they had a microgrid. Now, a microgrid operates as part of the bigger grid in normal times, but when the bigger grid breaks down, it automatically disconnects itself. It's called islanding. And so it becomes like an electrical island, and that electrical island is designed to supply not all loads, but all essential loads, your elevators, your key lights, your refrigerators that hold your medicines, because there was a hospital there, the laboratories where they, you know, do the blood tests and things like that. So they're essential facilities, even after such a catastrophic event, continued functioning without a break. And of course, they became a haven, I'm sure, for lots of people who didn't have anywhere to go and didn't have any power supply. So that's among the reasons we need to do this. And of course, decentralized sources like solar and combined heat and power using natural gas are very important in creating these microgrids. We actually have one that was inaugurated by Governor O'Malley in October this year in Laurel, where a real estate company that does sustainable new construction inaugurated a microgrid where they're going to get 20% of their power supply from solar. I want to push it farther. I'm currently doing studies on renewable energy in Maryland and advocating that we create microgrids that have a larger component of renewable energy. But we need to make sure that the supply will be reliable. So we're still working out the technical details. So I think it will probably take, when I wrote my book, I thought it would take until the middle of the century to complete the job. And I think today we could do it by the middle of the century comfortably. And if we really tried hard, we could do it faster.
Fantastic. And let's, you know, you mentioned Fukushima here. Let's just take a minute on that, because I know there are people out there who are concerned about the carbon emissions from the fossil fuels, and they're saying the climate change problem is so great that we have to consider relying on nuclear energy, which doesn't emit carbons. So, but then we look at Fukushima and we see not only the expense, which is way higher than we were told. I mean, originally they were pushing nuclear on us because it would be too cheap to meter. But we're looking at the huge billions in subsidies that have happened. Not only is it very expensive, but it's also very dangerous. You know, we had the tsunami wave hit and boom, Fukushima's got a meltdown. Can you just tell us, I know you were very involved in that situation, can you tell us kind of in a nutshell what happened at Fukushima and what does it tell us about the reliability of nuclear energy?
Well, we've known that all nuclear power designs that have been put forward, in my opinion, have the potential for serious problems. First of all, every nuclear reactor of 1,000 megawatts, it's roughly a standard size, makes about 30 bombs worth of plutonium every year, just in the course of its operation. So, of course, you can't use it directly, but if you separate that plutonium, you can make about 30 bombs with it. So that's one thing. Then, as the reactor operates, it accumulates these very highly radioactive materials, which are the products of fission. You split the atom, uranium atom, you get two pieces, and those pieces are much more radioactive than the original atom, and they're very hot. So after the tsunami hit the reactors, normally the power got knocked out. So normally a reactor needs outside power to operate its internal systems. When the power gets knocked out, They have diesel emergency generators and batteries that can operate for a few hours, but their diesel generators got flooded out, and so everything went down. It's called a station blackout. Now, a nuclear reactor is very peculiar in that it has the fire. It's a boiler with a fire inside the boiler. Those are the fuel rods. Now, with a coal-fired plant or a natural gas-fired power plant, you turn off the fire and there's no more heat input into the boiler. You still got a lot of hot water, but it'll start to cool down. With a nuclear power plant, even though the reactors all shut down, the heat from the accumulated fission products, the waste that's inside the reactor, is so large that even without the nuclear chain reaction going on, it would boil the water off. And once the water boils, it reacts with the fuel tubes, creates hydrogen, and the hydrogen can ignite and cause explosions. And we saw three pretty good-sized hydrogen explosions at Fukushima that destroyed the buildings, the secondary containment buildings. There's also a lot... Sorry.
Is that what's called a nuclear meltdown?
Yeah. So what happens when the water starts to boil and goes down to the level of the fuel, the steam reacts with the fuel tubes, and you start, and everything becomes much hotter because the reaction releases even more heat, and the fuel starts to melt down. And you also get hydrogen as a result of the chemical reaction. So two things happen at once. The fuel starts to melt down and can go right through the walls of the reactor. And that seems to have happened to some extent at Fukushima. The first time, I think, that it happened in a reactor of the type at Fukushima. And we have 23 of them in the United States, plus 8 others that are very like it. The other thing that happens is you have hydrogen accumulating in the containment building and secondary containment, and that exploded. So now we have multiple levels of problems at Fukushima as a result of that. But even without this consideration, going with nuclear energy for addressing climate problem is not a good idea. First, we've got the plutonium problem. You mentioned nonproliferation at the start of your show. But I always tell people we don't have a shortage of low CO2 sources of energy. We have a shortage of two other things for solving the climate problem. We have a shortage of time, and we have a shortage of money. And nuclear is bad on both counts. So, for example, a few years ago when we were thinking we'd have climate legislation from the U.S. Congress, people were talking about a nuclear renaissance. And there were 30 plus reactor license applications or proposals. Out of that, only 4 are being built. We have had 0 new electricity from any new reactor in this country since, I think, 1994 was the last new one that came online. In the last... 8-10 years, we have 50,000 megawatts of wind energy come online. So one of the advantages of wind energy, for example, is you can build them in 2 or 3 years. And if you build half a wind farm, you get half the electricity. If you build half a nuclear power plant, you get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look out 10 years ahead for planning your electricity. And I suggest to any skeptic about what I'm saying is if you go and look at utility forecasts of electricity 10 years ahead, going back to the 1970s, they're all wrong, almost uniformly wrong. And what happens if you overpredict, you spend hundreds of millions or billions of dollars on power plants that you then have to abandon because you can't afford to finish them because
yep.
there's no demand for it.
Gotcha. We need to pause now for the break. Okay. When we come back, we'll talk about solutions and the plan of action for going carbon and nuclear free, the practical plan for that for the United States. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Dr. Arjun Makajani, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Dr. Arjun Makajani, author of the book Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy, and president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Before the break, we're talking about this amazing book that you've done and how you thought at first it couldn't be done, but in the research you saw that it was possible. And I love that you state a very clear goal, you know, zero carbon dioxide emissions economy, which gives great policy coherence and a yardstick by which we can measure progress. In your book, you identify 12 critical policies that need to be enacted to achieve this goal. Can you tell us what you think are the three most important things we need to do to have affordable energy without using fossil fuels or nuclear energy?
The most important thing by far, technically, is to improve the efficiency of the U.S. economy in the way we use fuels. Now that's a multidimensional problem. So we've gone some way to that. You know, we were not very complimentary to the federal government before, but some good things have happened in the last few years. One of the main good things that had happened that needed to happen was to mandate more efficient cars. So we're reducing our fuel use and making the economy function better and reducing pollution and reducing carbon dioxide. The other thing that we need to do the same in buildings and appliances. So that's also an area of some good news in that the appliance standards, the process of making more efficient refrigerators and freezers and lights and so on, that has been enacted and that is proceeding reasonably well. I've just finished an assessment of this issue with my colleagues. And to give you an example, when I started work in this area, a frost-free refrigerator consumed about 1,800 kilowatt hours per year. Today, you go to Sears or whatever store, you can buy a slightly larger frost-free refrigerator that will perform better, that is moreover cheaper than it was then, that will consume about 400 kilowatt hours per year. So we have removed 75 to 80% of the electricity consumption, have a cheaper refrigerator. Now, economists don't like regulations, but there are some areas in which regulations function very well, and some where they don't. Where they function, as in refrigerators, you have many refrigerator manufacturers. The technology was there, so they compete. And the standards were reasonable with a view to the technologies as they were available, and they have been tightened progressively. The same thing with lights. You know, a 100-watt bulb, today you can get a light-emitting diode bulb that will do the same thing pretty much. Some argue about the quality of the light, but there's some reason to some of that. But I think today you can get good quality bulbs that'll use just 1/5, 1/6, or 1/7 the electricity of your incandescent lamp. That's what I mean by revolution in energy. So we can eliminate about half of our energy consumption through very economical energy efficiency measures. What happens when you do that is because now you're doing the same things with less money than before. So you have some money to spend on renewable energy, even though it's somewhat more expensive than, say, gas at the pump or than electricity from coal. Now you can spend some more money on solar energy and your bills will not change. So the key number to focus on is not how much you pay per kilowatt hour or per gallon. The key number to focus on is how much are you spending per year on fuel costs for the amount you drive, and how much are you spending per year for the things you want, like TVs and refrigerators and air conditioners, to run them, not what the unit price of electricity per kilowatt hour is. And so when you take care of efficiency, your cost base for doing the same things goes down, and now you can afford to spend some to reduce your impact on the environment and balance out the costs. In the process, of course, you create a lot more jobs here because now we're using energy that's made in the USA. So the wind energy potential of the United States is vastly more than all the oil production in all the OPEC countries put together. Just that, and that's just wind energy. Solar energy potential is much bigger than that. We could generate, in Maryland, we could generate all the electricity we need just from the rooftops, parking lots, and spare urban spaces that we have. I've just finished this assessment. We have far more than we need in terms of our present generation, just from those areas. We don't even have to go out and cover rural areas or farms or anything with solar panels.
So you've just said a couple of very important and amazing things, and one of them is, if I heard you correctly, that we can eliminate half of our energy consumption through efficiency. Is that right?
Yes, that is right.
That is incredible. So I want you to, you know, think back. I know back in 1971, the forward-thinking scientist that you are, you did the first analysis of energy efficiency
right.
in the United States. So now here we are 42 years later, and this issue is still front and center. So what, with your 40-year span of looking at this, the possibilities of the savings both in money and in energy and pollution subsequently, where do you think we've come? What did you think back in 1971 when you first did the study showing where the savings were, and what do you think, how that compares with the savings that are possible now? And where have we made progress, and where do we still need to focus on this efficiency issue?
Yeah, we made a lot of progress, you know, because I worked in Washington for Dave Freeman when the first energy crisis broke. We were in the energy policy project, which he ran, which became President Carter's energy policy. And, you know, many of these initiatives for standards for the National Renewable Energy Lab, which was called the Solar Energy Research Institute at the time and so on, date from that time. So in 73, before the crisis, it was thought that by the end of the century, we would be using 200, I don't remember the numbers exactly, these are rough numbers, that in the next 30, 40 years, we've been using something like 200 quadrillion BTU of energy. So it doesn't matter the unit. So say 200 units of energy overall. All the initiatives, the people wanting to economize, resulted today we use less than 100 quadrillion BTUs. So less than half of what the energy we thought we would use, and the economy is, of course, two or three times bigger. So we are much more efficient. The automobile standards, of course, efficiency standards date from the 1970s. I know Dave Freeman was involved as a staff person in the Senate Energy Committee at the time. You ought to have him on your show. He lives in Washington, D.C.
Good idea. I'll call him up.
Yeah. But what we haven't done is in the mid-80s, the United States dropped the ball on energy policy. So the only real energy policy we've had is the one that President Carter gave us. Since then, there have been kind of bits and pieces which mostly continue the initiatives that were done then. So like the research at the Renewable Energy Lab, like the improvement, gradual improvement of appliance standards, and that is continuing. But there's no coherent overall U.S. policy. We're still spending money on coal research, on nuclear research. We're scattering limited resources in a lot of different directions, some of which is useful and some of which are not. Now, when you're doing research, you know, some things are going to fail. It's part of the deal. But I think we shouldn't be spending money in directions that have proven over half a century to be not successful. So
Well, that's kind of a consequence with President Obama and the people who go with the all of the above, which is kind of a politically palatable approach, trying to keep everybody happy, saying, yes, you can have oil, yes, you can have renewables, you know, yes, we can have nuclear, we'll do it all. But that's where I think your comment here is right. When you're scattered like that, you're going to have less impact. And that's where I think you stating a very clear goal that we want a zero carbon dioxide emission economy, if you have that as the goal, then it becomes much more clear where we want to focus our limited resources to have maximum impact.
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, Eleanor, I'm an immigrant, and I'm mystified by one thing. As I look at Washington, D.C., and I've lived here for a very long time, more here than in any other place in the world or in this country, and I am mystified by the fact that nuclear energy is somehow associated with patriotism. You know, somehow it's vaguely unpatriotic or not very politically good to be opposed to nuclear energy. I mean, during the 2008 campaign, there was some kind of competition of who's going to support nuclear energy better, and it became an article of political debate between President Obama and candidate McCain. Nuclear, it's just a way to boil water. That's all a nuclear reactor is. It's a water boiler that has radioactive fuel inside it. And it's a complicated and costly way to boil water that results in products that are very difficult to manage, and there's a nuclear waste problem, as you know, that we haven't been able to manage very well, and we've spent a lot of money trying. And but for a way to boil water to have political connotations rather than it being a technical, economic, and environmental decision is very mystifying to me. I guess to some extent I understand that, you know, it's associated with nuclear weapons and national security, but I still think the mystique about it is very strange.
Yes, and a mystique that's probably been cultivated by those who have been getting the billions in government subsidies to try to get that whole nuclear power thing going. Let's get back to this key point you raised about we can eliminate half of our energy consumption through efficiency. Where you've given us a reflection over the past four decades, kind of some of where we've made progress. At this moment, where do you think you were going to get the most bang for the buck in terms of increasing our efficiency?
Well, I think the automobile area is very important. I don't think even the current standards are pushing the technology where it should go. We already have cars that can get 50 miles a gallon. There's no reason why we cannot accelerate automobile standards to say 100 miles per gallon by the year 2030. At least I feel we have the technology. Cars have been made that get 200 miles to the gallon. So then I think we're already pushing electrification of cars and hybrids and so on. I think that's a very good development, and that is being married to renewable energy. We can do that somewhat better. I think that is, to some extent, just a product of the batteries are going to come. It's going to take 5-7 years, and a lot of investment is going into it. So I'm not worried about that. The thing we're not doing is we're not fixing existing buildings. So existing buildings, like the house in which I live, it's 50 years old, more than, and they were not built well insulated with good windows and so on. And I know I had an energy audit here, and we had some backfitting of insulation and plugging up various kinds of leaks of cold air into the house. We're more comfortable now, and we use a lot less energy. Somehow it's not very sexy or appealing to do that. I think we're too afraid of regulations. I think when a house is sold, not only should the electricity and gas and fuel bills be declared to the new owner, I think we should require that it meet a certain standard of safety and energy performance. I mean, we require radon testing, we require safety testing, we require certain fire codes be maintained. I see no reason, given the magnitude of the climate problem, and I think neither of us make a mistake, that this is not a problem of the first magnitude. No one has a perfect crystal ball about this, but everything we know indicates that this is a terrible, terrible problem, economically, environmentally, and so on. It's a problem for us. I was hoping it will, you know, this is, you can hope that this is not going to develop in the way, and we all cross our fingers and it won't, but we cannot act that way. So we've got to, I mean, they fixed the Empire State Building. The Empire State Building today consumes a lot less energy than it did 10 years ago. Every window was taken down. Every window was tightened. The same windows, it looks the same. You wouldn't know that anything was done there, but it uses a lot less energy. And we know how to do this, but we're not requiring that it be done. We're too afraid that it's somehow not going to be free market. Well, you know, the government is part of the marketplace. The government is there to make sure that things are safe and that things will be here for the next generation. And this, I believe that is part of it. The other thing we need to do is to, I think standards for certain appliances have lagged behind, like air conditioners. Air conditioning uses a lot of electricity. It's a very wonderful thing to have, as you and I know, living in this humid summer climate. But I just got rid of my old system, and we put in a geothermal heat pump. And I think my air conditioning electricity consumption is going to go down by 60-70%. I haven't gone through a summer yet. That's just my estimate. So there are areas, so mainly it is in the area of buildings, mm-hmm. and appliances and cars, the things that we've talked about where we've mm-hmm. made some progress. In the area of lighting, I think we've done very well. I like the lighting bill. I think the lighting improvements will happen steadily over the next 10 years, and we don't need to do a lot more. But I think in the areas of the high energy consumption, water heating, space heating, air conditioning, and some of the more important appliances, we need tougher standards, especially for building envelopes. They're too leaky.
You know, this is so encouraging to me. On the one hand, as you're talking, I'm thinking, well, you know, none of this is like whiz-bang technology. It's not like, and I think that's part of the mystique around nuclear. It's like, oh, my God, most people can't understand how it works. It's this cutting-edge new technology. The stuff you're talking about fixing existing buildings, insulating them, lifting the appliance standard, that all sounds, you know, on the one hand, you think, well, there's nothing magical about that. Could that really matter? But then when I hear you talking, I'm going, you know what? That means to me that this is all within reach, because everything you talked about, we're already doing. It's just what we need is a push to it and to, you know, lift it, get the greater efficiency standards, and make it more of a requirement. So it's not just someone does it because they're aware of the climate crisis, or they realize they're going to save money doing it, but someone will do it because, hey, I can't sell my house until I meet this code.
Yeah, now actually these traditional things are being married to whiz-bang technology. So one of the things that is happening, you know, in the transformation to people having, millions of people having solar on their rooftops like I do, and then a geothermal heat pump to do my heating, is I can actually change the temperature of my house from my mobile phone. I can monitor it from my mobile phone. I can monitor it from my laptop, no matter where I am. There's circuit boards in that geothermal heat pump downstairs that will allow it to pick up signals from sensors outside, and I can actually set, eventually, it's enabled, but I don't actually have all the technology on the outside of the house. I can eventually make it operate so that it'll be the most economical operation possible. The motor that it has is a variable speed motor or two or three speed motor that is much, much more efficient because of the electronics and the way the motor is made, and it functions in steps, so that when the requirement for heating is small, it functions much more efficiently than it pushes when the requirement for heating is larger. Now, so there's actually quite a lot of high-tech built into this, and soon we're going to have a lot of high-tech built into our dishwashers and clothes washers and so on. So one of the ways to deal with the problem of, you know, what do you do when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, is we're going to know the cost of electricity can change from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock. That would probably be a good thing. So that, or and it would be cheaper. It should be cheaper when we have a lot of sun and wind, and it should be more expensive when we're less. And we should be able to set all of our appliances to operate, if we want, at the cheapest time. So your clothes will automatically, you'll load up your clothes washer, and then it'll automatically turn on when electricity is cheapest. And it benefits everybody because you don't have to have a lot of installed power generation, and you get your power cheaper than you would otherwise. And we don't have to store it in a battery when it's plentiful. It'll just run your dishwasher or clothes washer at that time. So this smart grid technology is very new and very important, and can not only save money, but can make this transformation possible. So there's some very exciting things. The grid of 20 years from now will look as little like today as the phone of today looks like the phone of 20 years ago. Totally different technology.
Wonderful. And you have a wonderful plan here with the, you know, the 12 major, the clean dozen action steps that we can take here. Some of them, you know, we love because it's stopping what's not working well. You know, stop the subsidies and the tax breaks for the fossil fuel industry and the nuclear industry.
Yeah, you see, I'm very conservative that way, Eleanor. I don't like subsidies.
Right. No, I'm with you. If we really had free market, we'd have renewables, would be way down the line, but we've been pouring billions and billions into fossil fuels and nuclear, so let's stop it. It's not working. And then also we want to stop the subsidies for the biofuels. You put at the top of your list the limit on carbon dioxide emissions. So could you, and we only have a couple of minutes left, so if you could be really brief on this, but could you just talk a little bit about, you know, what do you think of a carbon tax or cap and trade, or do you support either of those?
Yeah, I thought cap and trade would be more efficient, but looking as to how the legislation went, it was such a mess, in my opinion, that in a way I was glad that the eventual legislation did not pass, because I didn't have a very good opinion of it.
Mm-hmm.
A carbon tax would be a good thing. You could refund the tax in part, especially to low and middle income people, and then use the rest for accelerating the conversion. But I don't think we're going to get a carbon tax. I think the states are doing very well. So, for instance, in Maryland, we have a requirement for 20% renewable by 2022, and the governor has proposed that we accelerate that to 25% by 2020. California has a requirement for 33% renewable by 2020. Now, that's actually, in a way, the equivalent of a carbon tax, because renewables are somewhat more expensive than existing energy. So what happens is efficiency gets pushed on the one hand. So we're doing a lot of efficiency in Maryland in the Empower program. They're doing that in California. So energy bills are kept down that way. And then the renewable portfolio standards kind of serve, in my opinion, as a stand-in for a carbon tax. Similarly, automobile standards kind of serve as a replacement for a gasoline tax. Actually, I think they're much more efficient than a gasoline tax, because gasoline only affects such a small part of the operation of a car, maybe 20% of the cost of the operation of a car. So it's much direct to have efficiency standards for the car. So I think states like California, Minnesota, Maryland, and many others, if I'm remembering correctly, even Alabama has a renewable portfolio standard. So we have stand-ins for a carbon tax, and if we could have a carbon tax, it will be okay, but I don't think today we need one.
That's great. And our time is up now, but I just want our listeners to know that they can learn more about your work on your website, ieer.org. And when I went on your website to do the prep work for this show, I noticed you're generously giving away free digital copies of your groundbreaking book, Carbon Free
exactly.
and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy.
Yeah, so it's been downloaded more than 750,000 times.
Fantastic. I hope all our listeners go to ieer.org and learn more about your work and get a copy of this wonderful book. So that's all the time we have. Dr. Arjun Makhijani, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Thank you, Eleanor, for asking me. It's been good to be on your show.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thank you for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.
Now that we know it, let's really